Hello and welcome, Transformation Talk Radio listeners and podcast listeners everywhere. My name is Ellen Stewart, and I am the pushy broad from the Bronx.
She's the pushy broad from the Bronx, New York. Follow her voice, a straight dog is nice. She's the pushy broad from the Bronx, oh yeah. Don't be surprised if you wanna listen twice. Make decisions, find the right choice. Know yourself better, find your own voice. It's okay if you need help today, cause everybody needs a little push. From the pushy broad from the Bronx, New York.
Welcome, Transformation Talk Radio listeners. My name is Ellen Stewart, and I am the pushy broad from the Bronx. This weekly show airs every Wednesday on Transformation Talk Radio and podcast stations everywhere at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern. Welcome to Women Who Push for More. This is where I interview enterprising, self-aware, and confident women who strive to achieve more in every aspect of their lives and have learned to never settle for less than they are worth. Inspiring and empowering stories of true pushy broads whose strength and courage makes us all want to be women who push for more. I am delighted to bring to you one of those women today that has a powerful story that I know many of you can relate. Please join me in welcoming Johanna Dazier. Hi, Johanna. How are you?
Hi, Ellen. I'm good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
I was given your name through a mutual friend of ours, Sarah Stewart, who was on my show a couple of weeks ago, a colleague, a friend, and a wonderful novelist. And she said to me after the interview was done, you have to interview my friend Johanna. You have to do that. Aww. And I immediately called you and said, I have to hear your story.
No, that was interesting. I love Sarah. I watch your podcast and I watch her interview, and it was an honor for her to tell you that. And here we are.
And here we are. And the first thing that I loved about you is that you live in Franklin, Tennessee. How long have you been there?
In the area, 13 years. Moved from Brooklyn, New York in 2007 and made the move with my husband and at the time our six-year-old to Middle Tennessee. So it was a culture shock to say the least, but I love it now.
Well, that's the other thing I noticed about you. You had a 718 area code and I said, this is a Brooklyn girl. What is she doing in Franklin, Tennessee? And I really love Tennessee because I worked for 8 years for a Nashville company that I absolutely adore, and I love the people of Tennessee. So those are two places that are close to my heart. And even though I'm the pushy broad from the Bronx, you know, we still love Brooklyn girls too. We do.
I get it. You know, but I have some good Bronx friends too. And here we are, Brooklyn and Nashville. So
that's correct. That's right. So tell me a little bit about your background. Let's start from the beginning. Where is your family come from? Where were you born? And tell me about your childhood a little bit.
Absolutely. Well, I was born and raised in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. My mom was a single mom at 19 in Haiti. So add that as different, as hard as it is in the States to be a single mom at 19, imagine it 10 times worse in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. That was my first example of a pushy broad woman who pushed for more. I had one of the best childhood in Haiti. I went to some of the best schools. I didn't, in my mind, I didn't lack anything. I didn't realize I was in Haiti until really I came here to the States. And I was, you know, shocked at the view of Haiti because she created a very good cocoon for me where I thrive. I had friends and I went to school and whatnot. So now I really appreciate what she did for me and how she raised me, given where Haiti was and where Haiti is. She's my first hero and my motivation for pushing for more.
You are not the only one that has said to me that with strong mothers come strong daughters.
Yeah. And she, man, was she ever the best example? And that's the reason why I do what I do. And I push for women's voice, for Haitian women's voice, for Black women's voice, and I'm raising a 19-year-old daughter. So now I can only wish and hope to pass on the baton to her.
So you said that mom took you to the United States. About how old were you when you came here?
When I came here, so my dad actually came back into the picture around 11, when I was 11, and he was already married here in the state with my stepmom. And another woman who pushed for more. And even though I was the outside child, she told my dad that Johanna's coming too. And so when she got the green card going for her own daughter who was born in Haiti, she was like, she's coming as well. So I say I have an amazing bonus mom. And so I came here, I was 12, and we lived in Orlando, six of us in a two-bedroom apartment. And another example, like I said, of women who pushed for more was my stepmom, all of us raising all of us while my dad worked to make sure put food on the table. She loved me like I was her own. So
you mentioned that your mother protected you and shielded you down in Port-au-Prince because of what the world thought of Haiti. Explain that to me a little bit. What was that about?
Yeah, I think so. I think she, you know, not having grown up with much in a province outside of Port-au-Prince. So when she came to Port-au-Prince, she had me, the thing she gave me, I went to an all-Catholic private school in Haiti. We had a driver who drove me to and from school. She worked at the now actually crumbled General Hospital in Port-au-Prince. She was an administrator there. I think during the earthquake, it was one of the big ones that crashed. She was administrator there. I would go to, you know, hospital parties with her. I never understood and never grew up with the concept of how bad the poverty and all of that, because, you know, we were blessed enough and she worked hard enough to make sure that I had a normal childhood.
So you came here when you were about 12.
Yeah, we lived in Orlando for 2 years. And when my mom herself now came, because again, a pushy broad, a woman who pushed for more, I was her only child at the time. So there's no way she was going to be away from me for too long. So she came and after 6 months, she came and got me in Orlando. And she told my dad, you know, thank you. We appreciate everything, but I'm going to take my baby with me to Brooklyn. And so, you know, it was struggle. You know, I think I experienced struggling living with a single mom in Brooklyn, New York, and seeing her take any job she could to feed her daughter. She then subsequently had my brother with my stepfather. And again, she worked hard to put a roof over her head to make sure we're in the good part of town. And so, like the strong young girl I was, I helped raise my brothers while she went to work and worked 2-3 jobs, maintaining good grades. You know, that was non-negotiable. I was, I'd say, A-minus student throughout high school while taking care of my two brothers after school, while she worked, cooked, you know, like the 90s kids, you know. So I experienced it, but from the Haitian parent perspective, but also the 90s kid, like got home, closed, locked the door behind you, take care of your brothers, cook dinner, do your homework, and go to bed until your mom comes home. So it was a, you know, as a Haitian young woman having an experience in America through that lens, it was, I think I had, now I appreciate my upbringing because I think I have both sides perspective. The growing up in Brooklyn as a Black kid, but the Haitian as well in us. We lived together, took care of each other, and strive for more. I think that's what helped me stay out of trouble. You know, my friends were skipping school. I was like, oh, I couldn't, my mom would whoop my butt if I did that, you know, and I knew I needed to make her proud because I saw how hard she was working.
Yes. And I think it's not only Haitian principles or Brooklyn principles,
right?
It was your mother's principles and even your dad's principles as well. Yeah. So we're going to credit mom. That's what we're going to do because no matter where you're from, if you didn't come up with the, you know, no matter where you're from, you don't always have to be raised with those kinds of principles. And you had that. Were there any difficulties growing up for you? Any trouble situations?
No, I was a really good kid. I think navigating the world of the 2 years I live in Orlando, my dad, I'll never forget it. When we got off that Pan Am flight, my dad was a professor in Haiti. And then he came here in America and he was a maintenance man at Disney. And that's actually how he retired. And I remember him telling me, education is your meal ticket in this country. And he instilled in us to immerse ourselves in the culture really quickly, learn English, become one with the culture, and take on every opportunity that was given to you. And so when I moved with my mom in Brooklyn, I still heard that voice in my head. And so I was, you know, any struggle was more navigating peer pressure, you know, in Brooklyn in the 90s, you know, the rap era and all of that. And I went to a, you know, kind of really rough school in a rough part of town. And so maintaining who I was, doing the right thing when everybody else around you was doing the wrong thing, especially in that early 90s, 92, 93, 94 time. And so the struggle was balancing the responsibility of not letting my parents down with peer pressure, because I was 14, 15, 16. It was the time to do whatever I wanted and live life. But here I am, I was more responsible about, okay, I got to go pick up my brothers at daycare. I got to take them home. I got to feed them. I got to do homework. So if there was a struggle, my childhood between 14 through about 18 didn't look like normal. I had almost adult-like responsibility, not because my mom put it on me, but because I wanted to be that help for her because she was doing so much for us.
It's very interesting that you said that, because many kids that age between 14 and 18, the most vulnerable, certainly the most impressionable ages, and the greatest chance for serious danger to happen to them, quite honestly.
Yeah, and it was all around me. It was all around me. And, you know, it was by my mom's, you know, credit to my mother and by the grace of God that I was able to maintain and just knew the goal. I knew the objective. I knew the goal. I graduated high school in the top 25 of my class. I got a partial scholarship to Iona. So all those things, you know, were big for, it was a first in the family, you know. And again, I credit my mom, because even though all those things were happening around me, you know, during the time, like the riots were coming on and there was a lot of racial tension and whatnot, she managed to keep me, to keep my eye on the prize. And so, you know, I credit my mom for that.
Do you remember some of the things that she said to help you do that?
She led by example. In Haitian household, mothers and parents don't talk, like have sit down talk a lot. They lead by example. Like there's not, you know, I remember my mom telling me I love you, you know, all the time. But there's this thing in the Haitian culture where they say, yeah, Haitian parents don't say I love you too much. You know, the way they say I love you is by a roof over your head. They work two jobs. They put clothes on your back, you know. And so she was busy working. So her way of telling me that I can be better, I can do better, was her doing better. So it was her example. And I loved her dearly, and I still do. I love my mom a lot. And so there's this thing of not wanting to hurt her and not wanting to not please her. So it drove me to do better. So it wasn't something in particular. It was just the way she lived her life.
We'll be right back. Are you ready to transform and empower your life by changing the way you think, feel, and act? Then it's time to schedule a coaching call appointment with me, Ellen Stewart, Pushy Broad from the Bronx, certified empowerment coach and recovery coach. My style of coaching is part cheerleader and part drill sergeant, always in your corner and at the same time giving you the push you need to truly move forward and exactly what you need to take command of your life. If you are ready for the Pushy Broad from the Bronx, I am ready for you. Visit my website, pushybroadfromthebronx.com, and click on the link that says one-on-one coaching. Make an appointment today. Welcome back to my show, Women Who Push for More. This is Ellen Stewart, the Pushy Broad from the Bronx. I am having a conversation with Johanna Desir, who is talking to me about growing up first in Haiti and then in Brooklyn with a Haitian mother that had a very strong moral code and taught her to be respectful and to really be an asset to the family. Let's continue that conversation. Well, that's an extremely powerful example of a woman who is a pushy broad and who pushes for more, like you said, but also it's a testament to your strength and to your respect for parental authority and parental guidance, because there are many people that respect their parents and still don't want to do what they should be doing. So I think a lot of that is your own personal credit. And I think part of that also is having a good sense of self, because it's really difficult sometimes not to succumb to peer pressure, no matter where you are.
I agree. The sense of self, I didn't know what it was until I was in my late 30s, the whole sense of self. As I became an adult, I understood what it was. But I, at a very young age, I knew what was right to do and what wasn't. And I wasn't swayed by people telling me you should do that. If I didn't feel it, I didn't do it. And so I had a very good sense of who I am, where I wanted to be, and what was right and what was wrong. But I didn't know what it was. I just thought I was different, you know. But in my late 20s and 30s, I realized, oh, so that's what that is, a sense of self.
So for young women out there that are between the ages of 14 and 18 and are struggling not to succumb to peer pressure, what kind of advice can you give them?
Absolutely. Well, my daughter's 19, so I went through it, you know, living in Middle Tennessee, being from a very Haitian family, a bit sheltered. So obviously, I'm doing better in life than where my mom was, where then at my age. And so my daughter is a beneficiary of doing better in life, living in Middle Tennessee, somewhat the middle class. And so I said the only thing I did differently than my mom was I actually sat and had a conversation with my daughter. I was in her life. I was active in her life. I listened to her and I also gave her advice on, you know, you're a young woman, here's what you want to do, so on and so forth. So if I had to give advice to between 14 and 18 year old going through stuff right now, seeing it from the eyes of what my daughter went through, first, I empathize because it's really hard out there for them at that age because so much is trying to grab their attention, peer pressure, and just so many things in the world grabbing their attention. Definitely find your why. Find who you are and be unwavering about it because things will change. Things will come and go. Even friends will come and go. Your feelings go up and down. Your feelings are not to be trusted. But what is to be trusted is to ground yourself in a set of principles that don't change. There are a certain set of values and principles that won't change, whether you're 14, 18, 20, 28. And so find what those are. Lean into your parents. Lean into, like, if you have a good relationship with your mother and find what those are. And sometimes when you stand up for those principles, it's not going to feel good in the moment. You may feel weird. You may be an outcast. But know that there's a vibe out there that's going to catch. There's a good karma out there that's going to catch those steps, the stuff that you did, that step that you took, and it's going to come back to you tenfold. And stay on that. Don't, things change. People change. Vibe change. Circumstances change. Fashion change. You know, technology improves and changes. What doesn't change is who you remain to be. Be true to yourself.
Perfect. That's really, really great advice, especially like you said today, how fast and how quick things move around. All right. So here you are, a young woman now in Brooklyn, and you're going through school and you're going through high school. And then what? You graduate school and then what?
So I graduate school. I accepted the scholarship for Iona. It was a culture shock. So Iona's in New Rochelle. And again, grew up in Brooklyn, New York. So it was a culture shock up north in New York. And so I actually, the next semester, I transferred to Long Island University, downtown Brooklyn. You can't get the Brooklyn out of me. So I transferred to Long Island University in downtown Brooklyn. And at the time, there was so much going on. And my high school sweetheart, who was a ordained minister, believe it or not, at 20. And he asked me to marry him. So I did what every crazy 20-year-old in love do. I drop out of college to marry my high school sweetheart. Started our lives in New York. It was my first experience at Women Who Push For More. So here I am, a college dropout, a Black woman. So I checked almost all the stereotypes, right? And I dare go to some of the biggest hospitals in Manhattan and apply for jobs. And I was confident and I went in there and wowed them. And I landed my first real job in healthcare at St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital, working for a multi-physician ENT practice. And I actually ended up staying with them for 7 years. So
what did you do for them?
I was like an administrative assistant. A lot of my doctors also were surgeons. So I managed their patient schedule as well as their surgery schedule. So that's how I started learning about insurance, which is what people, you know, think I'm the insurance guru. I'm the RCM, revenue cycle management guru. That's where I actually started learning about policies and healthcare and people's plan and the cost of insurance and people doing surgery, because I was getting those things either authorized or paid for my surgeon and my doctors. And so I learned, and I was learning it in the best canvas, the best schools in the world, and hospitals in New York City. New York City has some of the top rated best hospitals, best surgeons. So at 20, you know, here I am at the forefront learning from some very powerful and smart man. And there were, they didn't go easy on me, and I took it and I learned everything. Like, that was my foundation. And it was an amazing experience. I'm still friends with some of my old bosses and surgeons and whatnot. When I go to New York, we hang out and we're Facebook friends. But what I learned from them was, I think I pushed myself because I knew, not having a degree, I had to be the best person in the room. I had to knock out the interview. There couldn't be, it was almost perfect, striving for perfectionism, because I know my resume was missing something. But again, I say by the grace of God, but with hard work and determination, I climbed that corporate ladder really quick in a very competitive market in New York City.
So not only that, but you found a niche that not everybody likes, because when one person says the word insurance, everybody's going, oh my God. But I love the fact that you're so enthusiastic about it, because being in the industry, and we'll talk about that, what that is, we do have to be very familiar with insurance. And in today's world, insurance is a topic that people have to know more about, because everybody is confused when it comes to insurance. And it's certainly the topic of political discussions, especially now. And it's all about medical insurance. That's important for you. So that's a really good thing. So if you're an expert at it, oh boy, I'm sure our listeners have like 9 million questions for you.
And it's funny you said that. My friends will say, you are the only person that I know when you say insurance, deductibles and premium, that actually lights up. Like, what is wrong with you? You're the only person. It's because I learned and I carved out that niche, because I saw when patients were coming in for surgery, this is actually where it came from. I'll never forget a patient who had a cancer growing in their face. And my doctor was brilliant. I mean, he's amazing. And the patient had an $8,000 deductible, and they didn't understand what that was, why they had to pay, because they're already paying the copay. And so I felt this empathy, and they were foreign. And so you had the English barrier. I felt empathy, and I was like, somebody's got to understand and break that down. So I took classes. I took coding classes and billing classes. And I didn't just take them just to tick a box to get a certification. I wanted to dig deep into why they write policies. Why does Blue Cross Blue Shield write this pre-existing? Why does Cigna? And who, like, yeah, I get very excited about that and explaining it to people.
You are unbelievable. And your friend was right. I don't know anybody that lights up a room talking about insurance but you. On that note, is there any advice that you have for our listeners right now? Something that you think they should know going forward?
Yes. So open enrollment is coming up now, actually. Open enrollment opens in the fall. And I think the misconception people have is that open enrollment is only for people looking for Medicare, because they saturate the market with commercial. Open enrollment is also for if you're working with an employer and you have a group plan and they're changing group plan, because they usually do that during that time, because the employer group is looking to shop what's best for them and cost them less money to cover those lives. Get to know what policies they're buying, because a lot of people, they've been at their job forever. Oh, I've had this insurance forever. And then their deductibles and copays have changed 5 different times. And they're like, wait, what? My deductible's so $500 more now? I thought, so definitely find out if your employer is switching plans. Find out if the plan excludes stuff, pre-existing, depending on what happens politically, may come back, may not come back. There's waiting period pre-existing. And then there's still some diagnosis pre-existing, even with Obamacare. And so you have some chronic diagnoses that are still not covered because the payer is looking at it from, I'm not going to keep paying $30,000 for you to keep getting this chemo drug or this infusion drug. They put that diagnosis and they slip that in the policy that they rewrite. And then all of a sudden now what was covered a year ago is now not covered. So really do, my consulting, that's one of the things, branch of my consulting I do. So my consulting is twofold. I work with the facilities in the hospitals, but I also offer help to patients and family members, people looking for, hey, I have a policy I don't understand. So definitely do your own research, even if you have a group plan through your job. Ask to see what the policy covers. Ask to see if there's any exclusion. So that's the advice that I would give people who are listening, especially if you are insured through your job.
And if you are insured through your job and you find that the policy is lacking in some way, can you as an individual supplement that insurance in any way?
Yes, you can. You can. You definitely can supplement these on the open market with the Affordable Care Act. Now, the thing is, it just costs you double now because now you're paying technically two premium. What's coming out of your paycheck through your job and what you're not paying out of pocket for the supplement for what is not covered. So yes, if you are, you know, that person who could afford to do that, but you have a care that you need that your plan through your job is not covering, then definitely do that. But most people can't. And so they end up paying out of pocket. And even that, if you have to pay out of pocket, a lot of those doctors, those private doctors, don't be afraid to negotiate with them. Because I'm in the industry, I've had services that were not covered under my policy. And I was like, so listen, I know it's going to take you 90 days to get paid on this to make $1,000. How about I give you $600 up front to do this, you know, simple biopsy and call it as paid in full, you know? But it's someone that's in the industry that knows that who will go to those doctor's office and do things like that. And so I go around giving my friends advice on certain things like that. So yes, you definitely can supplement but look at the cost to see which one is better. And sometimes if you've been with your doctor for years, you know, like I just saw a dermatologist and I was like, you know what, you don't have to file my insurance. It's $150 for the visit here. So I negotiate. I was like, it's $150. What if I pay you $110? Call it payment paid in full, because they don't want to go through the cycle, which is what my consulting is, revenue cycle. Going through the cycle takes longer and that cost stays on their books. So any physician wants to get that cycle closed sooner than later.
So negotiation is possible and sometimes benefits you and benefits your provider.
Yes.
Okay, that's stellar. So here I can't believe it. The first time, and I don't even know how long, I am sitting in front of a woman who's excited about insurance and has made a career of it. Continuing on, here you are, you found your niche, right? You found your niche. You're able to move up in the world, not only as a woman, which is difficult in the insurance industry. I know. I used to work for New York Life writing insurance manuals. I get that. Yeah. I spent 8 months. I couldn't have spent a day longer.
Longer.
I ran from it. I couldn't have spent a day longer. This would have must have been right up your alley. But nevertheless, I understood it was difficult not only being a woman, but then again, being a Black woman as well, correct?
Yes. Very difficult being, climbing the corporate ladder as a Black woman. I think I experienced a little bit more of the difficulties when I moved here, of course, to the South. When I moved to Nashville, New York was more, it was a matter, and that's why I love New Yorkers. It's a matter, can you do the job? You got tough skin. You can't get, like I said, all of my bosses, surgeons, were top male in their field. And some of them were like top rated right now in New York, have office in Park Avenue. I have office on the Upper West Side near Columbia University. So they, you know, they were not taking it easy on a 23-year-old. Like, you said yes to this job, earn it. And I worked hard and I learned to put that tough skin. Yes, I knew I was a Black woman climbing the corporate ladders and working with those doctors, but I think it wasn't one until I came here and started working in the call center mindset of big corporations that I realized this is a whole different ball game. And so my Haitian upbringing, my tough mama upbringing, my Brooklyn upbringing really came in handy, you know, and I was like, listen, I am going to speak my mind. I'm going to kick ass. I'm going to be the first one in, the last one out. And I remember telling my very first C-level immediate hire. He was a COO. And I remember telling, he asked me a question one day and I didn't know the answer, and the substance use disorder world, because it was my first time in it. And I remember telling him, this is the first and last time you're going to ask me a question on this topic and I won't know about it. I am going to become an expert at it. And true enough, knocked it out of the park. I went to classes. I sat in classes where master social worker people were sitting. LPS, LCSW, LPC were sitting. I told him, I was like, if you have the time and the money to invest in me, I will not disappoint you. And he did. He did. And I realized that I had to step out of my comfort zone and not feel like, because I didn't have a degree at the time, that I could be limited. If someone was willing to take a chance on me, I was going to step up to the plate and knock it out. And he did. And I did. And so my career just kept growing from that. I think within 4 months of being, you know, an insurance girl, I became a supervisor there and then a manager and then turned the department around and really brought RCM. We brought, you know, the billing in-house and realized, oh, we could do that in-house, partnered with other managers in different departments, learned the marketing side of it. Because once you know how a payer is paying and you understand the policies and the plans and the groups, you know, and when I say group, I mean, for example, GM is a group-sponsored policy. They offer Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan. So once I learn about Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan, I then learn about GM. I learn why are they writing certain policy? Why do they cover certain policy? And I click that information now to my bosses. I was like, hey, if you really want to help people in substance use disorder, go to the EAPs. Go to GM and say, here's how many of your patients have come to me so far with this disease. Here's what my treatment do. And it was brand new in the substance use industry. It was brand new doing that. I was certainly a little secret weapon.
Certainly innovative, and certainly the beginnings of really making that care affordable to large companies, to workers in those companies, and having EAPs, which is what we know as employee assistance professionals, helping those people get the treatment they deserve.
Correct.
All right,
correct.
So let's back it up a minute, sure, and let's talk about your beginnings, because you had a shift. How did you go from where you were in insurance and putting that to use and going forward to pivoting to the substance abuse field? Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So when I moved to Nashville, everyone was like, because I worked in two of the major hospitals in New York City, everybody was like, well, Vanderbilt is the big hospital here in Middle Tennessee. So apply for a job at Vanderbilt. Being a woman who strived for more, who knew there was something more in me I wanted to give, I worked there, to be honest, for 8 months, and I couldn't do it anymore because it was a lot of, you know, bureaucracy and, you know, all of that. And I wanted to be more, make an impact on the individual patient. You know, like I really wanted to be there for the patient and walk them through their surgery, walk them through whatever. So I applied for a job, Foundations Recovery Network. This is where we met Miss Sarah Stewart. This is how we met. Posted a job with literally saying they need somebody who's an expert in insurance, who could understand policies, talk to patients about deductibles and copay. It was like the job had my picture on it. I was like, really? So I applied and I took the job and I just climbed the corporate, you know, that's how I ended up there. I didn't have any experience in it. To be honest with you, I didn't even understand what mental health issue was. I remember my boss in the interview had to flip the back of his insurance card and show me the phone number to Magellan. And he was like, instead of calling the surgeries, you call Magellan for authorizations. I was like, oh, that's what that number is. I never paid attention to it. And I dig deep and learned. I got all the, as I was in the job talking about how I pivot, I realized I didn't have the experience and I didn't have the degree. So what I did is I, on my own, ordered a lot of substance use disorder book. I went on SAMHSA's website. That's the government website where you find help, and got a lot of books. I got a lot of pamphlet. I learned about opiate addiction, alcohol addiction, benzodiazepine addiction. I learned about the person that is susceptible to getting an addiction. And I learned about what the precipitating event that caused some of them to get. I did a lot of self-teaching on my own. Again, that was one of the women who pushed for more. You know, for me, why I resonate with this is I knew I had a deficiency in not having a degree at the time. And so, like I said, I always made sure I knew more about the task and how it would help me be better at my job. And so I just dug deep. You know, Sarah was working with us in the business development and intervention, and I just plugged with her. I wanted to know her. You know, I was like, tell me about your job. Oh, you have a master's in social work. Tell me about when you do counseling with patients. Like, I would always annoy her and call her and ask her questions. And, you know, I always wanted to be in the room when they were talking about patient care and stuff like that, because I wanted to tie it with the back end, which is the revenue cycle side. I wanted to be better at the back end. The more I learn about the disease of addiction, the better I can put the two pieces together. So that's how I got where I am.
You know, people don't see that side. Okay. I work as a recovery coach. I also am a life coach and an empowerment coach. And many of my clients suffer with substance abuse, and I help people that have gone to treatment, come out of treatment and live more productive lives, staying clean and sober. But what people don't realize is the people on the billing end, the people that are fighting for you in insurance, really want to know how they can fight. And you don't know how you can fight until you understand what you're fighting for, which is exactly what you are talking about. You're able to negotiate with the insurance company because you have a true understanding of the kinds of coverage someone needs in order to get well and in order to sustain that wellness. And also what the policies are in terms of parity laws, in terms of mental health.
ERISA law, parity law. I was very intrigued during the whole parity, like when that whole thing was happening, I was learning. I remember when, you know, some of those laws came in, I went and got all of them and read them line by line. You know, like there's some, you talk about some 700,000 page stuff. I was the only fool with my yellow highlighter and highlighting how it's going to affect the patient. Ooh, this is not so good. Ooh, you know, it's because you're right. As the back office, we're often in the back office for a reason, but we're the one who is fighting to keep your loved ones in treatment and on outpatient basis, to keep, you know, to find out why, because you want, especially once you understand the disease of addiction and you understand that recovery is a lifelong thing and people are going to need ongoing therapy and counseling and one-on-one, you want to make sure that their policy that they're working through their job or whatever that they're paying their premium for covers their care that they need. And so I became very passionate about, you know, learning and doing that and impacting those families. You know, there are times I would call with a family and I would say, you know what? Yes, I fought the appeal. I've appealed the third time and we got the coverage covered. They're going to pay for it. I've had, you know, moms and, you know, one of my favorite cases was a police officer out in New Jersey, actually. It was her third time in treatment. And when I told her that her 45-day stay, we fought the appeal and it was going to get covered. Keep in mind, she's a public servant and her plan was trying not to pay because it was her third time. Hearing that in her voice saying, "You did?" She's like, "Oh my gosh." You know, like that was job satisfaction for me. Like my boss could have given me whatever, it wouldn't have mattered than hearing the satisfaction on her voice that she wouldn't be responsible for thousands of dollars in treatment.
Especially since today's 30 or 45 day treatment is thousands upon thousands of dollars. For some people, the cost of a small home sometimes, or you know, stuff that people have to take personal loans out for that take 10 and 15 years to repay. So the cost of treatment is enormous. And the fact that you can turn around and negotiate and be the helping force is something that people will remember and thank you for the rest of their lives. And that is a marvelous thing. So what you really do has a tremendous meaning and has given you so much personal joy that you are now moving into an exciting project of your own. And when we come back, I'd like you to tell us about that. We'll be right back after this. Are you ready to transform and empower your life by changing the way you think, feel, and act? Then it's time to schedule a coaching call appointment with me, Ellen Stewart, Pushy Broad from the Bronx, certified empowerment coach and recovery coach. My style of coaching is part cheerleader and part drill sergeant, always in your corner and at the same time giving you the push you need to truly move forward and exactly what you need to take command of your life. If you are ready for the Pushy Broad from the Bronx, I am ready for you. Visit my website, pushybroadfromthebronx.com, and click on the link that says one-on-one coaching. Make an appointment today. This is Ellen Stewart, the Pushy Broad from the Bronx. This is Women Who Push for More. I'm having a conversation with Joanna Dazier. She's about to tell us about the new journey she's about to embark on and how she is able to move forward and help a lot of people. Let's listen.
Yes. So after 10 years of being in the back office and working with the boys, telling them this is how it should look and working and whatnot. In 2015, I started consulting, now working with the programs and substance use disorder, establishing a good revenue cycle for them, like putting more people like me in their back office that knows how to do it well. After doing that for 5 years, I was with a client in Atlanta, and one guy approached me. We were at an event for interventionists and EAP, and he goes, "So you're the famous Johanna." I'm like, "I don't know about famous, but I'm good at what I do, but I don't know about famous." And he goes, "You're so good at this, and you understand the clinical aspect and the revenue cycle aspect. Why don't you have one of your own?" And I'm like I remember looking back, like, is it talking to somebody else or is it talking to me? Because I never thought, as much as I believe in women empowering and you could put your mind to it, set your goal and get it, I never thought of that for me with regards to having my own program. And he was like, and then he goes, I was like, you know what? I don't know why. And then I said, I know why. Funding. If you could get me, if you could get me $3 million, I will have my own. And he goes, so you're telling me a woman as smart like you, a Haitian woman, determined woman, Black, you're telling me money's the only reason why? He was like, I challenge you. And so we've been on the journey to get my own up and running, and we are very close. I want to do it because you said something, you know, a little bit a while ago that said, I believe in recovery. I believe in, even though, you know, I myself am not in recovery for addiction other than shoes, but I believe in the story of recovery. I believe in people getting a new lease on life. I believe in giving people chances to find recovery and be sober and lead a productive life. But I also believe in doing it right. Being in the industry, substance use industry, I've worked with the players who didn't do it right. I've worked with the players who I helped make a lot of money because I was so good at what I did in the back end. And I can, at one point, I couldn't do it anymore. I was like, I know I'm so good at what I do. It can't be about the money. It's got to be about really helping put people back together so they can go back to their community and empower their community and be a force within their family, then their community, then their city, then their country, so on and so forth. And they're like, man, this is a leader like you is what this industry needs, who could see both sides and actually be genuinely appreciative of it. And so we started the journey in early 2019. We have found a program that we are in the right now trying to partner with to take over. And I adore this program. I've worked with them before. And, you know, I'm excited about it. I'm excited. We are, you know, just a few more legal stuff to get through and a couple of more $100,000 there to close the deal. But we're getting there. I'm super excited about it.
So what you're looking for is funding, you said, right?
Correct. We're close. We're very close. We've got partners so far. We're looking for one more to come in and, you know, close the loop for us. I've been working on this blood, sweat, and tear. I call this my 5 to 9 because I actually have a regular 9 to 5. And I call this my 5 to 9 in my weekends, where I'm reaching out to people, attorneys, and all of that, you know, to finally put it together. And we're very close. We're very close. I'm very excited about it. Putting together a group of people who share the same values that I do, who understand the impact you could have on people's lives, who understand the impact you could have in your community, and that there's a great need out there, especially given COVID-19, what's going on right now. Mental health and substance abuse use has gone through the roof with what's going on right now. And so a program that really helps people find recovery is needed right now. And so right now, because of what's going on, we've made a little bit more further stride to get to that point because there's a great need right now, but we're almost there and I'm excited.
So if people want to participate in some way and maybe think about a partnership or think about additional funding, we're going to put your email address up on the YouTube channel, but would you give people a way of contacting you on the podcast?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. My email address is Johanna, Johanna.Desir, Desir, @gmail.com. I have it on my phone, my iPad, my work phone. It's everywhere. I have a phone stuck to my hand. So again, it's Johanna.Desir @gmail.com. Like I said, we still have room for one more partner to come in and really help us close this deal. But we, like I said, we've identified the program already. We've gone through the vetting process, both sides, both attorneys. And so we, like I said, we've done all of that legal stuff going. We're just very close. And so I'm super excited about the next journey of putting together a program that is close to my heart.
That's absolutely marvelous to follow your passions and to move forward. And are you treating you? It's adolescents and adults or just adults?
It will be adults for now. The business plan we created, we're focusing on adults, male and female. We are looking with our attorney. He's also had some background in that field as well. Currently, right now, we're doing some market research to look at the two things, to look at the adolescent population and to look at the African-American population, focusing on African-American, you know, mental health and substance abuse is ravaging that community as well, but there's not a lot of resource. And then there's still a huge stigma for African-American people to reach out for help. And it's even more of a stigma in the Caribbean nations, like, you know, mental illness and addiction is a no-no. I remember when my family started understanding what I do, they're like, what is that? You know, if you're not a doctor, a lawyer, or nurse, you in the healthcare, you're like, what do you do again? And so it's because there's that stigma. And so definitely I want to develop a program, maybe it could be up north. You know, we're looking at, you know, places in the Northeast area to have a program to, you know, to address the need in the African-American community as well.
I understand stigma. Most cultures, you know, go through that as well. I know in the Orthodox Jewish community, in some of the other communities, the whole idea of asking for that kind of help and saying that you have a problem with something is something that everybody wants to shove under the rug. Is that what's happening in the Black community?
Yes.
Not supposed to have those problems. Nobody talks about those problems. Is that what's going
ma'am.
On?
Yes, ma'am. And it's particularly, I remember one of the things I did when I worked with all of my other jobs and my clients, one of the things I did to understand how insurance pay and why insurance pay, you kind of have to create a profile of the user. You kind of have like male, 32, you know, like you kind of have to understand, you know, primary drug is alcohol, primary drug is opiate, you know, childhood, you know, you kind of have to create a profile. And being a little bit of SVU, Law and Order SVU detective that I am in my mind, I started creating a profile of white male, female, young, Black male, Black female, education, background, even their down to their genealogy, like great-great uncle, trauma. So I started creating a profile of the user coming in when you do their assessment. Because again, in the beginning was so I could talk to the insurance company. So I can say, this is why you need to pay for the 23-year-old who got into a motorcycle accident, was giving prescription, you know, Oxycontin, and now he's using heroin. Here's what. So I had to kind of create that profile because that's how the insurance companies talk to you. But now I started, I took that same format and now use it on the front end to now understand how do we get to them before that we need to get in the back. Like, how do I found the 23-year-old who was raised into, you know, a loving home? What triggered him to get, you know, on opiate and heroin? What about the 23-year-old cheerleader or the 45-year-old Black male who's, you know, support working two jobs to support his wife and, you know, life is hard. So I started creating profile. And so I kept all of those research. And when, like I said, when I started talking about doing my own thing and I met with some of my partners and talked with our attorneys, they're like, my goodness, like you really are passionate about this. Like, good grief. Like you really took insurance to a whole new level.
But you took it to a personal level. And that's what it is. People do not see it on a personal level. And neither does insurance. Insurance doesn't see the person, right? Like you said, the 45-year-old man who has two children or the 23-year-old who's trying to make ends meet and maybe trying to go to school and whatever or struggling through whatever they're struggling through. You take it to the personal level, which is why insurance has to go in that direction. Because it's not, as much as we have to have standards, we have to have standards that fit the individual. So in terms of the patterns that you seeing, is there any kind of general patterns you're seeing in Black America in terms of how this is going? I mean, how substance abuse in the country is going and the kind of patterns that you see? Can you speak to that?
Sure. absolutely. It starts with young male at around the 18 to 25 year old. And of course, the pattern is they don't have a male role model in their lives. You know, my two brothers are an example of that. And they both have legal issues. You know, my mom was a single mom raising the three of us. I was the oldest. So, you know, I kind of had that standard bearer. But because of the lack of that male influence, they found it out there in their friends. And it went from, you know, smoking the weed to something stronger to then alcohol. And then to now they're doing, it's consumed them, the drug and what has consumed them. So then they put themselves at risk. That's what they call it. They call it, there's a person, I think it's the number 6 dimension on the ASAM, the American Society of Addiction Medicine's criteria for people getting into addiction. It's the 6, it's their environment and what precipitate them to the drug use. And so a lot of them will put themselves in danger, which is the illegal. For girls, it's prostitution or selling themselves. And so you see those behaviors that you see exhibiting in the community is the precipitating event to the drug use, to the alcohol. And then by that time, you're looking at somebody who was 23 23 and 25 started using, and now they're 42, 45, and they've been using all of this time. So they have poor health, and that's a lot of them who can't get access to insurance. They don't go to the doctors, right? Until it's a chronic liver issue or kidney issue or debilitating. And then now the healthcare system is trying to address it from the medical, never having addressed the mental and addiction piece. And so that's the trend that I kind of see. And so that's why I said, again, we're probably going to look at, you know, adolescent, because if we could take it from the adolescent and give them some strong foundation, then they won't have to be the 45, 55, you know, going into the hospital to detox, but their liver and their kidney and everything is shot.
Certainly starting young has its advantages. There's no question. Yeah. And changing the whole face of insurance, we need you in government right now.
I had a friend of mine who was like, and he meant that in the nice way. He was like, you should be a lobbyist, but a lobbying for the people. Like your voice, it's like lobbying for the people. Like the way you just put it is exactly what people need to hear. And I was like, oh, you know, I used to want to be in politics, but I think I'll have more impact doing what I'm doing right now.
Well, no matter what, you make it extremely passionate and personal, and it bridges the gap. I mean, I haven't heard anything on both sides of the aisle that comes close to how you can literally game change the insurance industry in a way that can be effective for everyone. You know, it's amazing what you said. And I know that whatever you put your mind to, you will succeed at, especially this. So please keep me posted and keep us posted when this project is coming to fruition, for sure. And I'm sure it'll be the first of many, because I'm sure it will not only be one, but maybe a series of of things as time goes on, because this certainly is where your heart is, for sure.
It definitely is. I joke that I was blessed with only one child, my precious little rainbow baby. And I said, I think it's because God wanted to give me this as my next child to really impact other people's children and other people's loved one and other people's husbands and wives and whatnot. And so I'm all in. This is my calling. I'm all in.
That's fantastic. So I want you to leave us with some words of wisdom for the Black women out there, for women in general, about being a pushy broad. Because as I said, my definition, my backronym for the word pushy is powerful, unafraid, self-aware, hardworking, young at heart female. Do you identify with being a pushy broad, Johanna?
Absolutely. As a 42-year-old mom, wife, entrepreneur, Black Haitian woman, the first of in the family to do many things, I definitely am a pushy broad. I am unapologetic about my voice and how to use it. I stand for truth, righteousness, how to do it right. I empower women. I have mentees in Haiti that reach out to me. I love to see women succeed. And so what I want to leave women, Black women in particular, with is you are told that your voice don't matter. You are told, you know, there's certain bucket, there's certain role that you fit in. You know, not to get a little biblical or anything like that. One of my favorite quote is, I am wonderfully and fearfully made. I was given and empowered to have I am given everything that I have that I need in order to be the best that I can be. And so if God has given you all of those, who is man to tell you that you can't use what was already gifted to you by the gift of grace? And so I said, you just got to tap into that. Follow your true compass. Your true compass. Know who you are. Know what you stand on. Don't compromise, because there is a little girl, even a little boy out there that the gift you have in you is going to change their life. There's someone right now, I believe in all my heart, in their depth of addiction right now, who is in despair that somehow our roads is going to collide and they're going to end up in my program. And they're going to say, I've been waiting for this. And that's what drives me. Is because there is somebody out there waiting for me to take that first step. Not easy. It's not easy. I'm overcoming a lot, but it's definitely going to be worth it. I really believe that.
Johanna Desir, thank you so much for being on my show, Women Who Push for More.
Ellen, thank you so very much for having me. It was a pleasure being here. I've now watched all your podcasts yesterday. That's what I did all day yesterday. Watch your podcast. I'm inspired by the women you've had, and it's truly been an honor to consider me and now for me to be on your podcast. So thank you so much for what you do. I appreciate it.
This is Ellen Stewart, the Pushy Broad from the Bronx, saying thanks for listening. And remember, everybody needs a little push.
From the Pushy Broad from